Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you for tuning in to episode 8 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. We've got a great guest today. I've had a lot of people asking, obviously I say at the start and at the end often, if you've got any requests for guests, give me a shout on Twitter at Scroobius Pip Yo or on Facebook or wherever. And on Instagram and on Twitter, I've had a few people say, have I got any plans to have any female guests? And my answer is always no, because I don't plan based on sex. It always strikes me as an odd question. If you've got a specific female guest you'd like to request, then go right ahead. As I mean, this week's guest is indeed by chance our first female guest, but she wasn't chosen because she's a girl. She was chosen because she's got an amazing story and, in my opinion, is an amazing human. So it's Jodie-Anne Bickley. But before I get into that, I should do our sponsors. We've only got two this week. This week we are sponsored by Speech Development Records. That is my record label. That's why we get to sponsor the podcast for free. If you go to scroobiuspip.co.uk in the web store, we've got a lot of stuff on at the moment. I've decided to do a discount code for you podcast listeners. So if you enter the code SDR10, you'll get 10% off. Off everything. But I've got t-shirts in the moment. I've got jumpers. I've got winter bubble hats, but probably more interestingly, I've got my spoken word DVD or download. The digital download of it is £5 and the DVD is £10, but it's got interviews with people like Kate Tempest on there and Polar Bear and Moose Rock Wonga and Tim Key, all people that have been suggested for me to interview on the podcast. So that's good. I will get round to them, but in the meantime, you can grab that if you'd like. As said, SDR 10 for 10% off of that, so go and check it out. Obviously, we've also got B. Dolan's album. No, we haven't. He's not got his album out yet. We will have B. Dolan's album, I promise, but we've got the Sage Francis album, we've got the Polar Bear album, we've got the Giacomo Brown album, we've got the War and Peace album. Check it out. As you can hear, I'm a bit croaky, so I apologise for that in advance, but I wasn't croaky when I recorded the podcast. Our other sponsor this week is Onnit.com. Onnit is a human optimization website. They sell all sorts of supplements. They sell weight stuff, brain stuff, physical stuff, mental stuff. I recommend you check them out. And if you do, you can get 10% off by buying via onnit.com/ScroobiusPip. And that way you'll also be supporting the podcast. Thank you very much for that. But on to this week's podcast. We have got a young lady with an absolutely amazing story. Earlier this year, I interviewed her in front of an audience at Cannes Festival, and I welled up several times. The crowd cried openly numerous times. She's an amazing individual. I won't go into too much detail. I'll just allow our conversation to let you in on that. So enjoy. I'll be back at the end with more details of next week's show and a few bits of information, so stick around at the end. But for now, this is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 8, with Jodie-Anne Bickley. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. So we are recording. How you doing?
I'm good.
I'm here with Jodie-Anne Bickley. How are you on this rainy day in Birmingham?
I'm pretty magnificent, actually. I'm feeling pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm good. We're upstairs in a little hidden room at the Hare and Hound, and this is one of the first places that we met properly, I think.
I think so.
Because I think we kind of met over Twitter or Facebook or MySpace or whatever over email initially.
Yeah.
But I'm sure the first time we properly chatted and hung out was when you booked me and Polar Bear and Ed Sheeran. What a lineup in the current.
I know, right?
And a few others to come and play was it Speak Up?
Yeah.
Speak Up.
It's sold out.
Right. And yeah, we did that. And that was the first time I met Ed really as well, and I'm sure that's the first time we properly talked and hung out, right?
It was a really good night.
And then you've come along here one time when I had my club night here, and someone passed out sick and an ambulance had to come and look after them. And yeah. I think you hated a girl with dreadlocks that night for some reason. I'm sure she won't be listening. Yeah, we can discuss this. It's fine.
The girl with dreadlocks was in love with you, I think.
You seem to find her annoying. I've never met her. I hardly spoke to her, but you did seem to think she was horrible.
Well,
that was it. It was a friend that had
the... Yeah, a friend passed out
issue.
In the toilet and we had to get her out and stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's been a great podcast. I'm glad we got to let people know about the girl that passed out in the Hare and Hound. But yeah, you used to do a spoken word night here, didn't you? How was that? What made you decide to go from being a spoken word artist to, right, I'm going to take on organising a whole night? I mean, we're going to get on to the fact that you're always quite happy to try and take on far more than one human should accept. But let's start at this early inclination of that.
I kind of fell into like doing poetry and stuff anyway, and when I won the Roundhouse Slam, I realised there wasn't actually much going on in Birmingham with poetry, mm-hmm. because we didn't really have any spoken word nights or anything. So,
which is crazy considering Polar Bear is one of
exactly.
the most known in the UK poet scene in recent years. I'd say him and Kate Tempest are probably the two I would credit as most responsible for the boom, and the most people that you hear now that sound like Kate Tempest or Polar Bear, they seem to be the catalyst for a lot of what happened.
Exactly, and Polar Bear had moved to London because there was nothing really here for poetry. So I was coming home to this and there was nothing here for me to do the thing that I'd just fallen a little bit in love with. So I decided to create something, and that's when Speak Up started.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. It was really good.
Don't realise how little it takes to start a scene, and not meaning that it's not hard work, but how, I mean, my memory at the time, I think you and Matt Windell were the two poets I knew of from Birmingham, and therefore in my mind Birmingham was a thriving spoken word scene. But then, you know, I mean, that's all it takes.
Yeah.
That a lot of people who hit me up saying, oh, we've not already got a scene where I am and things like that. It's like, well, if you and one other person do it, then if you start a night above a pub like this, then more people will see that, and, you know, a scene builds quite quick. So,
yeah, definitely.
So how did you find that? Did you feel that that was the case?
I just made my space. Just some friends would come along to the first few, mm-hmm. and then their friends would come, and then people would hear about it and they'd come. And it wasn't necessarily people that had ever like heard like spoken word or poetry before. It was just the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It was like a little. It was like creating a living room outside your house and just making it warm and nice and putting something that you love into it. And it was really lovely.
It was really a nice mix as well, I think, because you'd bring people from other places and you'd have... But you'd also have not spoken word. You'd have people like Eva Lazarus and other people like that... I don't know. It was all completely different genres, but it seemed to sit comfortably together and make evening.
It was quite organic, I guess. Yeah. It just felt... It was never hard. It was just putting some people together and them turning it into something magic. And it really was.
Yeah, yeah, that's all good. I also remember it was at this place. I'm going to turn my phone over now.
Because
we're both glancing over at the fact that people are texting or calling us. So, so it was also here. Obviously, there's a huge thing that we're going to talk about, mm-hmm. which we're going to get to quite quick. I'm teasing people with this now. But it was also here that I remember you telling me that, or talking to Polar Bear more, and him getting quite angry about a teacher had told you that your poetry wasn't very good, or you could never be a poet, or you'd got a bad mark or something. And then
it was really bad. I was I'd just gone to uni because I wanted to do English with creative writing, and I'd got in without any qualifications, really. Okay. I'd got in with just my writing.
Yeah.
And then I got in and my creative writing teacher turned around to me and he was just like, if you write like this, you're never going to be a writer. You're never going to make any money about with being a writer. You could be a teacher or something, but you won't be a writer. And it just completely broke me.
That's
I'm a bit of a fragile little flower sometimes.
Negative thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah, he wrote it on. I think he wrote it on my. He wrote it on my work as well.
Yeah.
But I was like the bottom of the class.
Yeah.
Like, he really didn't like me.
I then relished after that seeing you do spoken word at festivals all over the place and being successful and adored in that way, then it just shows that kind of it's such a, I don't know, individual and personal thing that you can't be, it can't be right or wrong as such. A teacher shouldn't be able to say...
No.
It's the reason I did photography up the road in Wolverhampton at uni for a year, and I stopped doing that for a similar reason, in that I suddenly realised this isn't really an art form that you can... or you should be able to get graded in and marked in, because it's art.
Exactly.
So it's not really a, is how you do it and this is wrong. It's, you know...
You have to go and do it and find your own little way, I think. I don't think someone can teach you how to write. I think you can give you, like, techniques to maybe tweak it and stuff, but I think it's kind of an in thing. You've either got it or you haven't, and for somebody to just be like, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Then you have to go and prove them wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So you did go and prove them wrong, and you went and did tons of spoken word everywhere. And we're going to jump straight forward now to Bestival, where you came and did my Satin Lizard Lounge stage. Was it 2011?
Yeah, 2010. 2011.
Mm-hmm. You'd obviously remember that. do you want to kind of explain what happened there?
Oh, it was
a good weekend.
Yeah, it was lovely. I had a lovely time. It was... it was one of my standout weekends. It was a standout summer. Like, it was Glastonbury and Bestival, and I was doing all my jobs, and it was just very, very busy and awesome. And when I got back from Bestival, I'd got, like, bites, which you always do when you're mm-hmm. out at summer. and I thought they were just normal insect bites, and they turned out to be bites from a tick, which happens to 1 in 200,000 people. Wow. And I'd got really ill one day and was a funny grey colour, and my mum took me to the doctors, and within 20 minutes I was getting a spinal tap and being told I had encephalitis, which is a brain infection. And
how old were you at this point?
Gosh, 23. Yeah,
that's
23.
Crazy.
That's when it was all happening.
And, yeah, so what was the kind of... what happened there? What was the symptoms? What did you have to through or get over? Obviously, it was a huge panic at the time for you and for your mum. I remember a Facebook message kind of saying to people, I'm sorry if Jodie isn't responding to anything, but she's in hospital and she's had, you know...
Yeah, I can't really remember much from the first few days, because the minute I'd gone to the doctors, I couldn't walk within 20 minutes. And then after that, I was on so much like medication stuff. It's kind of all a bit of a blur. But it was just the worst headache you've ever had in your life. It was like somebody had like thrown a rock at the back of my head.
Mm.
And it was constant.
Had anyone thrown a rock at the back
nobody,
of your head?
Nobody. I don't think so.
Yeah,
I'm not
sure.
I don't think they did. And then I lost all the sensation down the one side of my body, and they thought I'd had like a mini stroke, and I had to learn how to walk, and I had to learn how to write and hold things. And it was a lot to get over. But then after that, that's when the ME kicked in, and that was the biggest challenge yet. I'd lived the brain infection over and over.
That's insane. So, I mean, just not that I'm wanting to harp on anything in particular, but it blows my mind the thought of, as a writer and as an artist and creator, to have to learn to write again, learn to walk, learn to do everything again. Mm-hmm. How was that as an initial thing to think, this is what I've got to overcome? Or was it just you go into automatic, there's no choices here, this is happening?
I was surrounded, like, my family have kind of always been, we get on with it.
Yeah.
There was no time.
You're from Birmingham.
Yeah.
You're Brummies, that's a fact.
Exactly,
that's
there was
ingrained.
No time. There wasn't a time for, like, a pity party. Like, obviously, they were worried and cared about me, but we were doing it together, and it was a team effort, and I wasn't just learning to walk, and we were. And it was hard, and there was tears, but there was a lot of laughter, and it made it... That time, I don't look back on, and it's not the worst thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
It happened.
Which sounds crazy,
I know.
But yeah.
It happened, and we got over it, and I learned how to walk, and I learned how to write, and I did it.
Yeah.
So it was difficult, but it's done.
And then, what came next? Because I know you kind of, being as determined as you are, you wanted to go back to work.
Yeah.
You wanted to work and do things. And
I went
how
to
did
your
that
night.
All...
I'd gone back to work in the February. No, maybe the beginning of March of 2012,
mm-hmm.
and I was better until probably the beginning of May.
Yeah.
And I'd gone down to We Are Lizards and hung out, and I was fine. And then come back in the middle of May, and I crashed, and my legs went I couldn't walk, and nobody knew why. And I was back in hospital, and they were doing tests for things like MS and crowding on my brain, because they thought I was going to have brain surgery. And then some people thought it was just migraines. Some people thought it was just from the encephalitis. And it was a whole process of having to rule things out. And whilst they were ruling things out, other symptoms were coming along. Like, I was having mad, like, massive fits. And I was having about 10-15 a day that were really violent and scary, and they were putting me on medication that was creating them, and then they were taking me, I had to be taken off them, and it was just a really scary time. And then I got diagnosed with ME, which didn't really make anything better. It kind of just put a label on it.
Yeah, so I mean, as horrible as it is, it must be all the more scary. And I remember I told you at the time, and then not knowing what was wrong, or not knowing if things were helping, if things were making it worse, that kind of uncertainty. I think it's great that we've got the NHS and everything else and such a great medical system, but there's so many things, particularly when it comes to the brain, that we just don't understand. And it's petrifying that it's trial and error when the stakes are so high. It's trial and error on your brain, on the thing that controls everything in your being. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So when they told me I had ME, at first it was the, oh, I know what I've got.
Yeah.
And then it was like, there's not actually anything to kind of help it.
Yeah.
I can take painkillers.
Were you aware of what ME was at the time?
Only through research, like whilst I was ill, looking at different things that it could be, and ME had come up. And been shot down.
Yeah.
And when they told me I had it, I became very aware that I wasn't the only one with it.
Yeah.
And
that
there's a lot of people, and it's only really just been recognised as something. There's still a lot of people that will still see it as like yuppie flu.
So can you explain ME a little more? I know it is a very misunderstood one. I know there was a big Ricky Gervais got a lot of stick because in one of his stand-up things he mocked it and made light of it. And again, I think it's from an ignorance and a lack of education on what ME is, because it's such a, as you've said, it's such a hard one to define, I guess. So it's tough that I'm now asking you to define it.
people that mock it, I kind of just want to just say, you know what, do what you want, come and live a day in my shoes. Because the worst days, I can't walk.
Yeah.
I have to move around. I can literally only move around on my bum, around the top of my house. I can't pick things up. I'm covered in burns and marks from where I've dropped hot things on me.
Yeah.
I find it hard to find words. My memory's really, even now, my memory's terrible. My concentration's bad. It's the worst time. I can't actually remember the last time I went to sleep and felt rested. I haven't had a rested night's sleep. I couldn't tell you when.
So when you got the text from me asking you to come in here now and then remember loads of stuff for an hour, that was obviously a heavenly invitation. Yeah. That's kind of poor timing, I guess.
Yeah, but it's one of those things you kind of have to learn to just get on with it. And because it's invisible, and because you look healthy most of the time, and except my really bad days where I literally do go the colour of, I just go transparent. But most of the time I look really healthy, but inside, in my head, I'm having the amount I have to do to kind of leave the house every day and to function is so much more than anybody will ever see, realise, or I'll explain to people.
Yeah.
So, it's difficult. Bit of a challenge.
Yeah, and a lot of different symptoms and a lot of things to get over. So you had the diagnosis now. Mm-hmm. What kind of happened next, and what was the process?
I got given a diagnosis. I got given a sheet telling me to do some graded exercise, and that was it.
Yeah.
And I was sent on my merry way.
Yeah.
We've
solved that problem.
Yeah, we solved it.
See
and
you later.
I felt like it should be solved now because I know what it is. Then the guilt sets in because you're not getting better, even though you know what's going on, and technically things should be working now. Mm. It wasn't. And that's when the depression kicked in.
Yeah.
And it kicked in so hard because you're trying to live a life. You're trying to live the life that you were before you were ill, but your body can't keep up with it anymore. So it's a constant battle trying to push its limitations when you can't, and it won't let you.
I think it's really interesting, your description there of it being invisible. I think that must be one of the toughest things, because it would be so hard to not question everything at points and question what's real and what's not real.
I've completely doubted everything.
It's not something that you can take a photo of or show on paper or say, here's what's real. It's you're getting the physical side of it, but another day you're absolutely fine. So
I had a broken leg, I could point and I could show you and I could be like, it's broken, this is when it's going to get better, this is when I'm getting my cast off, everything's fine. With this, I don't know if tomorrow I'm not going to be able to move. I just don't know, and it is invisible, and that's the frustrating part of it, because most people need to see something to believe it.
Yeah.
And I think I'm one of those people. Yeah, so sure. I started doubting everything. I kept thinking that I'd made it up. Really made everything up. I thought it was a fraud.
Yeah.
Especially because when you're ill, you have to go, having to be on sickness benefits and stuff that. I was just like, I don't deserve to be on them. I'm not actually sick. I'm making this up. And the depression that came in with that. And you just get into a big ball of it was self-loathing. You hate yourself for something that you can't control, but nobody else can see. So it's all within you. You can't do anything with it. And it's been pretty horrible.
Yeah. So at this point, people are probably thinking this is going to be a really miserable and unhappy podcast. But I think it's, in my opinion, it's the most uplifting and positive one we've done so far. So during all of this, when all the depression had set in, how did you deal with that? What was your solution to get into to bringing yourself through and giving yourself that drive and a positive thing?
Okay, so one night we'd come back from the doctors and they'd basically told me they couldn't do anything for me. I kind of had to just ride it out. I'd had about 300 tablets at home and just laid them out and had that moment of either I'm gonna end it now because I don't feel like I'm strong enough to get through to tomorrow, or I'm gonna have to find something that makes me want to get up for tomorrow. And that's what I did. I thought there's going to be other people that are feeling like they are in the bottom of the barrel right now, and I'm going to try and find them and we're going to get out. And that's when I set up 1 million lovely letters and sent a call out to everybody on the planet. If they were having a bad day or a bad month or bad life, to contact me by email. And I'd give them, I'd write them a handwritten lovely letter, the letter you'd want from your best mate on your worst day. And I expected one or two people to contact me, and thousands did and have, and it hasn't stopped.
Yeah, it's amazing and mind-blowing that at such a point when you've been through so much, you've finally got a diagnosis, expecting that diagnosis to come with a solution, but if anything, it was the complete opposite. That diagnosis came with, right, we know what it is, there's nothing we can do about that, go away and deal with it. And then to be that far down the line and your solution is to reach out and help others. And I think that's why this has been so embraced in general. So yeah, you set up the website. So initially you just put out a call and started doing these lovely letters. And how did it all develop from there? Because I know it went kind of crazy pretty quick, really, in the last few years. But let's try and take it gradually along that journey.
Well, I set the website up. It took me 20 minutes. And then I just posted it on Twitter and Facebook. That's all I did.
Yeah.
And then within an hour, 50 people had got in contact from all points of the world. I think one of the first ones I got in was from Australia. Mm-hmm. In the next few years, one from Delhi, one from Manchester, one from Chicago. It just started coming in. And I think it's because it's such a simple idea. It's such a human thing, to kind of reach out and be like, you know what? It's going to be all right. I'm a bit broken. I think when you put yourself out there, you know what? I'm a bit broken. but we're going to get through this. I'm getting through it. Let's do it together. And that's all it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people have responded to it. And
I mean, I think it's beautiful. It strikes me. And to kind of go back to that original talk of that teacher saying, if you write like this, you can never be a success or never be a writer. I think something that struck me from the first time I heard your poetry was it was so relatable and personable. It felt like you were almost overhearing a conversation. And I think that's why the lovely letters work so perfectly, because you have a way of instantly feeling familiar to people and making people feel comfortable and familiar in that way as well.
Even like when I was writing my poems, I've always wanted it to feel like you were sitting next to me and I was just telling you a story and I was talking to my best friend. I'm a bit of an open book, which comes with like its advantages and disadvantages, but I kind of don't care. Like I just put myself out there and see what happens, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, but it's doing me well.
Yeah,
and so people are relating to it.
So these initial first load of emails, obviously without having to go into any detail, but what kind of things were people coming to? Or was it similar to what you'd been through, or a million different?
When I say from the whole spectrum, I really mean it. I mean from somebody wanting a letter to put on their fridge, to someone going through depression, to someone who's just lost somebody to terminal illness, to a 81 year old man who had lost his wife and didn't have someone to like eat biscuits with.
Yeah.
And he wanted me to write him a letter just because he was feeling lonely.
Yeah.
People that have had miscarriages, like children that are getting bullied, teenage girls that are going through eating disorders, young men that are scared of coming out. It's everything, and it's not just women. A lot of people think it's just women, but it's right down the middle, the same amount of women, same amount of men, and it's all into my little inbox.
Is there any point you've panicked and felt kind of not unqualified but unsure of how to approach these things? Because obviously there's some huge subjects, some small subjects, but you know, have you ever felt nervous in that way, that wow, they've turned to me, what do I do?
I think because I've never ever, like on the website and stuff, I'm not saying that I'm going to make things better. I'm not a counsellor. Yeah. I'm basically just another ear. I'm just somebody else that's going to be in your army to like fight your battle. Like, I'm not going to fix it all.
It's one of the things I've always loved about the Samaritans. I didn't realise until my mum started working there years ago, who's a big fan of you as well. I always mention this.
Love but
and that they're not there to try to claim to help anything. They're not even allowed to discourage you from taking your life if you choose to. They're there to be an ear, to hear what you to hear when you need someone to hear. So was that a similar kind of approach on your side?
Yeah.
Was to go, right, I'm not going to be the world's saviour. I'm not going to claim to be that. I'm going to set out here to say, look, just let's chat, let's... You know, in a way, an opposite to the Samaritans, in that not necessarily you just being someone for them to share their problems with, but more the opposite of you just being someone to just give some positivity, kind of in context or out of context, but just that outside person to say, look, you're good,
I think part of it is that just to make it valid, make the fact that they're feeling something valid, because a lot of people are like, oh, I know so many people are going through so much more than me, and things like that. And it's just like, no, like what you're going through, it's real and it's yours, and you're allowed to have this moment.
It's a great point. I hate the term first world problems, because I think that really plays down. Just because worse things are happening in the world, it doesn't mean that what you're going through is irrelevant or not absolutely crushing or possibly too much for you as a person to handle.
Exactly.
And I think that's such a weird, it's always been one that annoys me, that it's not a competition of who's most miserable.
You don't have to be superhuman. Strength doesn't come from just like taking the world on. It comes from being like, you know what, sometimes just being vulnerable and being like, I actually do need help. I need somebody to talk to. There's so much strength in that. And the more people are like first world problems, it's just silencing people and making people's voices smaller than they should be, and that's how you lose people.
Completely.
And I just, that it really annoys me. It really grinds my gears.
So you got 50 or so in the first hour, and that's pretty much where it ended, right? Was that the end of it all?
No, it wasn't. after that, I got contacted by... what happened next?
It kind of got picked up by everyone, right?
Everybody that could picked it up did.
The Daily Mail were one of the first, and then numerous different publications and TV.
I found out the Daily Mail had written something when everybody else did, really.
Yeah.
My Twitter blew up, and someone was just like, oh, the Daily Mail have written an article about you. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea. So obviously this article was about the project, but also about me. It got various things wrong, but also it did capture the essence of the project, which was great. But then...
I mean, it's good to hear the... You know that if it's the Daily Mail, it's going to be appallingly researched, loads of poor information and loads of horribleness. But this was a positive story that they were using their weaknesses. So at least it was still an uplifting, positive thing,
still,
despite any... hating on the men, not Jodie. She's being very neutral, so that's fine.
Yeah, it was still a bit of a spin like, oh, girl with life-threatening illness does it, when it kind of didn't come from that. But if that's the way they needed to do that, that's fine with them.
Sure,
that's
course,
what they need to do. But then I got an email from Hodder and Stone, saying, we'd like you to write a book. And I was on my way to the hospital at the time with my mum, and I was just like, ha, who's Hodder? I don't know who Hodder are. they phoned me and they were like, look us up, and if you still don't believe us, then fine, but I promise you we are a book publisher.
Yeah.
Realised they were, and they put me with another lady called Kate Barker, who was amazing, and we wrote 1 million lovely letters.
Mm-hmm.
Then I also got contacted by the TED people in Birmingham and did a TED talk.
Yeah.
On the project.
Yes, I feel we're going at a million miles an hour now.
That all happened within 3 months.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy. So we'll get back to the book side of it. But let's quickly talk about the TED Talk, because I think TED Talks are a fascinating thing. And I think, again, it sounds like I'm being negative about everything. I think they've got so big now that, not that they're diluted, but there's so many different things in there now. Whereas I think... yours, obviously, I watched it, and it was just, it got such a huge reaction because of, it was just you up there kind of telling your story, essentially, and being
there
positive.
Yeah,
so how
was
that?
There was no smoke and mirrors. It was literally just me getting up and chatting.
And you say that as if it's a small thing, but how was it, like, just before you got up and chatted?
I had a panic attack.
Yeah.
I had a panic attack. I was really ill that day. I was with Polar Bear and my friend Zia. And I was sitting at the front having I had a panic attack at the front, and I text both of them to say that I was going home.
Yeah.
And I turned around, they'd both stood up, like, looking for me. But it was horrific. I was in tears before I got up there. But I was in tears because it really mattered.
Yeah.
Nothing had mattered more than that. Actually being able to tell the story. And... I felt so inferior to everybody else on that day, because there was people that had discovered mountains and mathematicians.
There's loads of mountains.
I know,
I know,
but these guys were really incredible, and I just felt like...
Discovering it, how do you miss it?
I know, right? But he discovered mountains.
Yeah,
these weren't
this
here
guy.
Before this guy.
There.
And then there was me. And out of all the talks that day, that one got the most... I don't know, most response. And it was nuts.
That's amazing. I think it's key to this story as well, which I think gets overlooked in some of the pushing of it, in the fairy tale nature of it, and having known you through this whole time. I think it's key to highlight that it wasn't all bad, 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 and then the good stuff happened and you were healed. Manic 3 months, you were still incredibly ill. And obviously up and down, but still incredibly
when
ill.
The TED talk had I was still fitting and I was still fitting, I was still very unwell. During the writing of the book, I had a really patient ghostwriter. She was very patient with me, but I had a lot of ill days where I couldn't write.
Because at that
anything.
Point as well, as you touched on the fitting, there was points where you'd fit numerous times in one day and be, you know, kind of constantly unable to do anything because you're just, you've lost control there.
Lost control. I was, they were outward fits, the from the medication that they put me on. The fits that happened were very outward. I'd punch people and kick people and have this Hulk-like strength. I'm a pretty dainty little flower when it comes to everything. But apparently I was as strong as the Hulk. And yeah, it would exhaust me and I'd end up in hospital. And there was one night I was in recess for like 6 hours and they'd given me enough like diazepam and stuff to sedate an elephant and I was still going. It was terrifying. It was terrifying. It was really hard to balance everything.
And all the while you're still having to then go, oh wow, I've got a TED talk to go and do, or I've got this book to write.
Yeah, it was hard and I don't think I ever truly enjoyed it. And that's the thing I'm a bit sad about.
Yeah.
Even with the book and stuff, there hasn't been a moment where I've gone, oh, I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
I only recently, for the first time ever in my whole life, said that I was proud of myself, which was a whole nother thing. But there was, throughout it all, I haven't actually sat there and gone, oh, wow, this is happening. Because I've been so, it's kind of going through a field, a really beautiful field with a steamroller behind you. Yeah. And you've just got to run.
Yeah.
You can't look around because if you look around, the steamroller's going to get you.
Yeah.
So I've just had to keep running. And yeah, I think at some point I'm going to sit down and think, oh, wow, that was awesome.
Yeah.
But it's not happening yet.
I mean, we'll go into the book now, but just before we do, I've just had another thought that I meant to say earlier. One of the things I think that worked so beautifully about the project, obviously that's what we're going to talk about in the book, but is the fact that it's a handwritten a letter. Do you think psychologically that makes a difference to people, as you were saying, to make them feel validated and valued, that it's not just an email? Because emails now and texts can be such a brief thing, and they're so discardable and throw away. So the fact that they were getting a physical thing that someone has written, and you write them in lovely colourful pens with stickers and all sorts of other things, do you feel that was, or was that a conscious thing, or was that just a natural thing that just happens to, I think, have been one of the keys to its success commercially, obviously, but also just on a personal level, on the success of how a written letter coming through your letterbox when you're feeling that isolated?
Always found like written notes and letters to be a little bit of magic.
Yeah.
Like I've kept things from when I was like in primary school from people, like in boxes under my bed, and it's always just been, just there's something a little bit like spectacular about it. And the reason I wanted to handwrite it is because these people were sending me their life stories, and I wanted them to know that for that moment in time, like, all my focus was on them, and I wanted to put everything back into it because they've just given me their everything. Why shouldn't I give them mine?
It would be easy to be cynical over email and assume there's some kind of template message that's then slightly adjusted to be personalised. But handwritten letter, that can't happen. This is handwritten. This is each word at a time is
like
personal
from me to you, and like in the rawest form. And I just see it as a little bit more. When a handwritten letter turns up on your, like, through your letterbox, it's so different because we're so used to bills and so used to, even normal letters are all typed now. Everything is typed. So a handwritten letter, I just think it's just so pure. And that's what I wanted it to be, just a really pure form of, like, you know what? You're awesome.
Yeah. So through all these ups and downs and fits, you got the book written, and then did anyone read it? Did that do anything?
Apparently someone it went into the bestseller. It went into the Sunday Times bestseller list.
That's crazy.
It's ridiculous. I feel like a fraud when I say it out loud. Like I don't really say it out loud very often. Yeah. When it appeared on the paperback,
I'll make you say it out loud every time we see each other. Just say it again.
Like even if you see me now, I'm just like, ugh, because I don't feel like someone that should be a Sunday Times bestseller. I feel like there's a lot of stories that should be Sunday Times. I'm not sure if mine should, like, is that important? But
well, you can't fight it.
I know you can't.
It's
there. It's done.
Do about that.
And people are responding to it. And it's awesome, but it's also made me the most vulnerable I've ever felt in my whole entire life. So it's come with, I wouldn't change for the world because so many people are aware of the project now. Yeah, that's awesome. But behind that, so many people are aware of me.
Yeah.
And I'm quite, I don't know, I feel, it made me feel very exposed. This whole thing has made me feel very exposed, and I'm just kind of getting used to it.
And hearing that, some people might think, well, obviously coming on Scroobius Pips, a world-renowned podcast, is a risky thing for the amount of exposure you'll get.
It's the only time I get to talk to you.
It's true. But let's go through a few of the other bits of exposure you've got, which may seem like any mild exposure from this would be pretty much unnoticeable. Where have you been and where has this been covered since the release?
Okay, so I'm going to forget things, so you're going to have to prompt me.
I'll try to.
We've been on the news, all of the news, BBC Breakfast, The Guardian, made the Independent Happy List, made the Sunday Telegraph.
And you were sitting there on the BBC Breakfast as well, right?
Yeah.
It's not just they talked about it, they had you in and going.
Yeah, they had me on there. They had me on BBC World News with John Sopel.
Yeah.
Who was terrifying. They've had me... Where else have they had me?
I mean, the coverage in America is kind of hard to forget.
That happened. I didn't, but it got covered on the Today Show. Good Morning America. People Magazine.
Yeah.
NBC did something. And that was all happening, like, whilst I was sitting, like, in my room back here.
Yeah.
With phone calls coming through from New York going, oh, can you tell us about this? Can you do this? And I was just like, this isn't happening. This isn't real. But yeah, that all happened. What else has happened?
I mean, it's crazy. All of the different support in the media, on TV and on radio has been huge. How have you kind of balanced everything in that respect? I know it's easy to get caught up in these things, but I mean, in general, it's easy to get caught up in these things. But when you've got a serious illness, how do you balance that and find that to work? And how angry has your mum had to get at you for taking on too much?
Oh, she just had a right go at me before I came here. But I'm still learning. Every day I have a little bit of a fist fight with myself because I think I'm only just learning to be kind to myself, just learning that this body is probably, well, is the only home I'm ever going to have. It's the only one I'm going to have. So I've got to start to kind of be a little bit nicer to it.
I think people, it's easy to forget that people you read about in the media or anything like that are humans. I had Sage Francis on the podcast a while ago, and it's a completely different thing, but he kind of highlighted about people complaining about when you don't come to a certain place on tour, and he tried to explain that he tours as much as the human body can allow. Like, there's only a certain amount that you can do traveling to all these places and performing every night and doing all this, and that's a healthy human body. So there's limitations to this. So have you had any kind of backlash from the idiot public who don't kind of realise that this is a real human here that's started this quite innocently, has now had her whole life changed, but is still trying to respond to as many letters as possible, but that's going to take a hell of a time and it's a hell of an undertaking.
The majority of people are patient
and
know that when they send a request, like I had one lady that didn't get a request, her letter for 6 months because obviously the peaks that they've been in like 1 week, I had like 1,000 emails come through.
Yeah.
I'm still battling through letter requests from like May.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have been patient, although there's been a handful or two or three that try and get me and they'll say, where's my letter? This isn't real, this is a con. I had a guy yesterday who I was doing a 12-hour day writing letters, and it was hard because these letters aren't, they're not just get better.
A quick note,
better.
Yeah.
These are life stories. These are some of these letters you cry through writing, and it's really difficult. And a guy had messaged me on Facebook, on my Facebook page for 1 million lovely letters. And he'd emailed me through Facebook, which I can't respond to.
I was going to say, and just to clarify, you have to, because of how big it's got, you have your email applications, essentially, or requests, and that's where it all has to go through. Because there's no way of keeping a log or note of if it's on, you're getting Facebook messages, Twitter messages, Instagram messages. Yeah. It's kind of... It's not you being mean in any way, but to make this a functional thing that you can, again, that a human can do, it has to go through the email. So you have to generally ignore the Facebook messages and things like that.
I can look at them, but I can't keep note of them. And also, I'm going to throw it in, my ME won't let me think more than like one thing at once,
really.
I start throwing different things into the mix, it messes me up and I get ill. Like, so this one guy had messaged me, I hadn't got back to him after 2 weeks, and was like, oh, this whole project is a con, you don't write letters. And I just broke down because I've had to start I'm learning that I've got to start putting boundaries between like my little fortress, which is me, and the rest of the world, because I've had people running.
Particularly with that much exposure, it's kind of incredibly tough. I mean, I'm willing to declare now that I will start up, what should I call it, 1,000 nasty letters. Just if you just forward the people who accuse you of being a con or whatever, I'll just write nasty letters to them saying,
you're not
how
the
about
first
fuck
person.
You?
You're not the first person to say that. People have been saying, I'll do 1 million horrible letters, I'll do this. But this, I, the way I've like dealing with it yesterday, I was just putting a status up and saying, look, everyone is so patient, but there's some people that aren't, and it's really difficult, and please bear with me. And the amount of people that rallied behind me and
support,
were just like, you know what, it doesn't matter, you're doing this, this is, stay true to it. And that's what I'm trying, that's what I hold on to, like the first reason why this project started, and the only reason I continue it is because it's a lighthouse. Yeah. And it's not just a lighthouse for me anymore. It was a lighthouse for other people. And that's enough. It's not what it's grown into. It's what it was and what it is.
Yeah,
and I try and... Everything else that's going on, I know can fade out. Like, the exposure will go.
Yeah.
Everything will go. And they'll just be me and my letters. And that's what I hold on to.
It's quite an insane thing that people hear of this project and fall in love with it. But 90% or, you know, a large percentage of the correspondence you have are going to be people asking for something from you, which is the nature of the project.
Yeah.
I'd like to put forth publicly now that the Facebook page, any messages on that focus on just telling you how great you are and not requesting anything. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of crazy that it's such a nice thing, yet it's kind of predisposed and naturally set out that all you're going to get is people... wanting something, even if they're saying it's lovely what you're doing, can I have a letter, blah blah, you know, etc, etc. So it's quite a weird situation.
I will give and give and give and give, but people just, they just have to bear with me a little bit, because I do still have days where I'm gonna have to have a day off, because I can't get out of bed, and
your mum is gonna kill you. Every time I see your mum, she's always concerned that you're overworking.
She's
and she's been so supportive and everything
she's
along the way,
awesome.
Just coming along to different things that you've done, always been your kind of your partner at all of these events and so many of these things. So
she's my best friend, my greatest ally. She's been absolutely magical. She's the slap around the head when I need it.
Yeah.
And before I came here, she was just like, I'm going to come with you. I'm going to tell Pip exactly what's going on with you.
Should do.
And I was just like, no, Mom, you stay at home.
When we did a similar thing to this live at Camp Bestival, I kind of interviewed you on stage. And number one, there was numerous points, which there should be if you're listening here, where people broke into rounds of applause over some of these things. But number two, the best thing was just glancing every now and then over at your mum shaking her head as you've taken on another thing. And that was my kind of indication of, right, that's, I know what is acceptable
and
what's too much.
We have a language in looks. And if I'm ever doing too much, like when I did my press tour with the book, my mum came with me because she says no when I should, because I have a tendency to just go yes, yes, yes to everything. And
it's why people, I mean, I don't. I know people get mad at it, but I think when people get to a certain level of fame or attention, I think it's not just acceptable, but essential to have a manager or an agent or someone that's there to not stop you being a nice person, but put things into perspective and make it real. Because, you know, to be able to say no, this is actually... Jody will say yes to meeting every single person here or writing every single letter, but there's a point where you have to say, we're going to have to stop for today and move on. So I think that's a key thing, and I think that's great that you've got your mum there essentially as your
security. Mum's always, she keeps going, do you know what, I'll be your manager. I was just like, no. Because I love her, I adore her, but we'd kill each other.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, two things together now. Roughly how many correspondences have you had so far, and also how much do you wish you'd named it 1,000 lovely letters or 10,000 lovely letters or something more manageable than
10,000 lovely letters would be okay. I've got 10,000 letter requests in my inbox because I was on the television the other week and it just spiked.
And what was this television show?
I was on Surprise Surprise.
How big was that?
Little bit. I think 3.6 million people watched
it. That's insane.
And a lot of them got in contact.
Yeah.
So it was awesome, but it's also bombarded my inbox. But I've worked out that if I write 33 letters for the next 39 days, I'll have the 10,000 done.
Easy. Easy. While we wasting time here, what's going on? So what have you done to make it more manageable? Because obviously, again, you started it as one individual person and then it grew into this huger thing. What kind of measures have you taken to try and make this? Because you did a Kickstarter campaign, right? And how did that all come about and go?
Well, I got turned down by some... I went to see some business dragons, and because they didn't think it was going to make any money, they turned down my funding. So I came home and I was really disheartened and decided to set up a Kickstarter just out of hope that somebody might want to help me, and put the... For the whole year, I said that I'd need £10,000 for it.
That's such a small amount. If I was your manager or mum, I would have been... You need to... Again, because all joking aside, as you were saying, you're taking on 12 to 14-hour days to get this done. So for assistance or for people to reasonably get on board... That's a tiny amount.
My mum and my friends had to actually shout at me to talk in a wage to the budget because I was saying, oh, I'll do this, but then I'll get a part-time job and be able to fund this from here and this from here. And they were just like, stop, because you've got to remember, like, you're going to kill yourself. You're doing too much. But it got funded within the first 4 days of it being up, and when I ended up with getting £12,000 after like taxes and things, but it ended up with 12, and now it means I have a little office, so it's separated from my house because it was my whole house was taken over by letters, and now I have my own little office and I'm getting volunteers in to help me out, and I'm going to be able to do workshops in schools, and I want to start pairing schools up and colleges and universities around the world and starting like pen pal things, one group of strangers to another, just reminding us that we're all good. And it's a lot to do, but I'm gonna do it. I think I'm gonna be all right.
That's amazing. It's so much to take on and to do. What is next? Is that the focus now, to continue with this, to do the workshops? Are you planning any other projects, another book? It's a horrible thing to ask, really, because I always remember seeing an interview with Dave Gorman and him saying how annoying it got, because the first thing he did was travelling the world to find other people called Dave Gorman, and that isn't his life. That's one thing he did, but then after that, like, so what's the next project? And again, this is similar. It's not, if people know your story, this wasn't a project that you set up. This was saving your own life, and you know, I'd be happy if you never had another project, because if what has to cause that project is you to get to the edge and being, you know, needing something to pull you back, then let's not have any more projects, basically. But
this right now is so big, I need to kind of find my feet back in it, and work out a structure to make it not only like it's going to be sustainable, but just so that I can cope in it.
Yeah.
That I can balance things and get more people in and get more hands on deck. I'd like to write another book, but that's going to... I want that to be later. I want that to be once I've cleared all of this. I don't need the stress of all the letters coming in having the book and then more letters coming in. Yeah. I need to clear my way a little bit before I take anything else on.
Where can people contact to go about offering any help, or to is the Kickstarter an open thing? Is there, can you take more funding, or are you going to start another one? Or?
I don't know. Do you know what? I find it really, really, really difficult to ask for help. Mm. I hate it.
I know you're a fan of the TED Talk from Amanda Palmer, which is about asking for help and about having the bravery and ability to ask for help. So
exactly. So and the Kickstarter for me, that was. It was like, it was so, like, I felt it was the most amazing thing in the world, but it took a lot of, like, oomph to do it. Like, I had to kind of talk myself
just
to...
put a PayPal button or something somewhere so people can just give you money if they choose to, which, as said, there's millions of people aware of what you're doing and amazed by it, so it shouldn't be as much as a struggle, is
it? I know.
Well,
on my, on the 1 million lovely letters website... Before the Kickstarter, before everyone else, everybody would always say, how do we donate to it? We want to help you out. Yeah. We want to help you out with stamps and things. So hidden on my website, and it's quite hidden, there's a button. And it says, if you want to, you don't have to, but if you want to like donate for stamps or Orangina or something,
something good.
You can put some money in, but don't feel like you have to. I don't want to... I don't want people to feel like it's they need to pay for a letter. That's not what it is. If they want to, awesome, because it's work. But
I think it's far more natural people wanting to donate because they don't need a letter, because they're not in that point. You know, it's kind of nice to know that you don't need that. It's just. When I spoke to my mum about what made her join Samaritans, it was because she was suddenly very aware that she'd never needed to call them and felt incredibly lucky at that. So it's kind of a nice thing to go, right, some people will read or hear about this project and think instantly, I need a letter, but a lot of people won't, and that's something that I feel is even more of a reason to support and get involved. Not that I see you squirming in your chair now because you don't want help or don't want to ask for help, but that's me putting it out there. We're almost on an hour now, and I want to switch up a little bit. Are you writing still, like, poetry and spoken word, or do you plan to write more or again? Not to add more things to your plate,
no,
but...
it's okay. I'm actually doing my first... poetry performance properly next week. Bang Said the Gun.
Said the Gun's an amazing poetry night as well. This will be going out after that's happened, so you'll just be
you'll just miss
be able to
it.
Look and hear about how amazing it was. But that's one of my I was in fact the first time I went, it was because you and I had agreed to go and you never turned up, so
I didn't actually agree to go.
We'd agreed
to this,
loosely
this.
In my mind, you know, I don't actually go out much. In my mind, we'd Lucy said we should go to that, and then I'd thought, right, that's happening. But I didn't regret it at all, because it's such an amazing night, and it's
awesome.
The first place I saw Rob Alton, who a lot of people
so
who
much.
Follow me on Twitter will know that I just think is the best thing in the world. And just as a night, I think it's great. I think the vibe and everything, it doesn't feel like a poetry night, or it doesn't feel like you'd perceive a poetry tonight to be if you've not been to one, or in fact if you've been to one, because it's so unique, it's got such energy.
It's the best
and
one.
Yeah,
it's, I think it's the best one.
Agree.
I love it. And going, it just makes me happy. But nobody knows how important next week is to me, because I've had the biggest case of writer's block, and I think it's because everything else has been happening.
Yeah.
And
it's not writer's block when you're doing 12-hour days of other stuff. It's that you're physically too busy to do this.
Yeah.
It's,
So I'm attempting to write at the minute.
Amazing. And
we'll see. I've gone through
heartbreak. Old stuff
so
as well,
we'll
or have you? That's always your best.
Yeah, the minute I've been through a heartbreak, my poems just get. It's like an Adele album. That's how
I it really is. It really is. So, are you going to be doing old poems and new
some
stuff?
Some old, some new.
Which is now leading me to say, would you be up for doing something now? As we're towards the end, or is that? I know I've sprung that on you. I haven't discussed it in advance, and I know we've spent ages discussing how it's hard to get your brain to function correctly and all this, and now I'm randomly going, can you just do a poem?
Yeah.
Are you up for that?
If I mess it up halfway through, though, we'll just start talking about
It'll be fine. So what do you fancy doing?
I'll do Drive Home, because it's right in my head all the time.
Perfect.
It's about seeing the person that you love in 20 years' time, and they're married with kids, and you're pushing cats in a pram.
I remember at first hearing this, and I'm sure you basically said that it was incredibly influenced by Adele.
I listened to someone like you a million times, and I was just like, oh my god, I need to write something like that's
your
my version experience. Of it.
Yeah
And that's what it was.
Well, go ahead.
Hope I remember it. I'm scared in 20 years I'm gonna come looking for you. I'm scared I'm going to have waited that long for you to remember everything I always knew. You'll look back and you'll remember my face from some place once. And I'll try and recreate that spark in my eye that made you fall for me in the first place. But this time it won't be love. It'll be heartbreak. And it's weird how shiny they make your eyes for different reasons. You'll introduce me to your wife as a friend you once had. And kids that we'd named on various drives home. I'd make up a husband, if only to hide being alone whilst praying for your divorce, but I'd never act upon it. Nah, I promise. I'm just scared all this is actually going to happen. I've got to prepare myself for it. You'd offer me a drive home and I'd pray for traffic. Talk about current affairs whilst I counted your eyelashes. 93 over 90. I hoped you'd lost the last three on wishes about me. How some days you couldn't be without me, but I'm guessing it's just old age at this point. I'd repeat, I'm not okay with this, over and over, so loudly, pressing the hazard light repeatedly in the horn so everybody could hear what heartbreak sounds like. Hypothetically, I wouldn't actually do that, but I'd want to. I'd touch your ring finger and say you'd been inappropriate, and I'd say, well, sometimes you've got to feel it to know it. So that's not how it works. I'd tell you to touch my chest so you could feel how it hurts, and you'd do it. Just to prove your point. And you'd look back on the road once I'd proven mine. If time is a healer, I'm counting every last second. I should talk about planned holidays, but I wouldn't listen. You'd say you're being stubborn. I'd say, well, at least you remember one thing. You'd shout, everything, and break. We stopped on double yellows, and I waited for you to elaborate. You didn't. You never elaborated. You made your point in expecting me to guess it like I have been all this time, and silence never echoed so loudly. I know that sounds cliche, but it hadn't. I said, look, breathe once if you love me and stop if you don't. You smiled and said in one breath, there's a spark in your eye that even now makes me think you're capable of ruling the world, and I've thought this day through a million times, but I didn't expect it to still hurt, and I know you still like rum and raisin ice cream. I can smell it on your breath. I loved you for the longest time, but sometimes you have to forget. We drove on. 15 minutes it took. I looked out the window and imagined myself in a Miranda July story and looked at other passengers in love with their drivers. I spotted one, maybe two. You have a beard now. You've never liked facial hair. It made you feel like a hobbit. You look dashing. I hate it. I thank you for the drive home, and you apologise for the traffic. I go to close the door, you shout, 83 over 90 eyelashes. Breathe out if you love me. This was Getting Over You. That's it.
Thank you very much, Jodie. And I'm so excited to hear that you're doing more spoken word and hopefully returning to all of that. We're kind of over an hour now, and I don't want your mum to text and get mad at me, so we'll start to wrap it up. But can we just end quickly on, can you just tell me a few of the amazing, exciting people that you've met since all of this has happened? Because I remember years ago, before all this happened, you and I would speak about a little club that if we could pick who we wanted to come and hang out with us and have dinner with us. No, right. And I know that certain people in that club you've now met and engaged with. So,
oh, no, it's
can you
mad.
Can you tell some of them to keep that smile on everyone's face?
Who have I met? I met Miranda Hart.
I was going to say, I know Miranda was definitely in that club.
She's definitely in that club, and I greeted her by running up to her and saying, "You're my favourite person of all time ever," and her looking at me and patting me on the head and going, "Oh, thank you."
Delightful.
And like giving me a little cuddle. That was nice. That means we're best friends. I'm going for dinner with Stephen Fry
casually
on the 11th of December.
Amazing.
Somewhere, which is going to be nuts.
That's
it's like having
insane.
Like having dinner with Yoda. It's
yeah.
going to be ridiculous. Who else have I met? Who else?
I think your idol Miranda and yeah. then Stephen Fry
still got to meet Adele.
We've been trying to put that for so long now. It will happen. It's next on the list.
It's got
well,
to.
Thank you very much for coming and chatting. And yeah, just look forward to seeing everything that's ahead. Where can people go to keep up on everything you're doing and to just watch on in awe?
Wicked. I'll be on Twitter at Jody and Bickley. Or
J-O-D-I-A-N.
I'm on Instagram with the same thing and 1millionlovelyletters.com. And if you want a letter, it's 1millionlovelyletters@gmail.com, not
don't,
Facebook
don't
messages.
Don't do it. Don't email. Every time we do this, I was like, why are you asking for what you've got? She's got 10,000 to get through. So just chill out. Just send support and maybe money and we'll
and
leave it at that.
And
cuddle, exactly. Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to chat to you. And
thanks
yeah,
for having
see
me.
You soon.
Bye.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we have it. If you can manage to wipe away the tears, that has been Jodie-Anne Bickley. I love talking to her. She's a dear, dear friend. So it was great to get to sit down and talk to her regardless of the podcast, but even better to hopefully get her story out to a few more people, particularly as it's one that's so personal to me because I kind of feel I was in the middle of it for a lot of that time, which was a very odd thing. But yeah, I hope you've enjoyed that. On next week's podcast, we're going to have another person that I've spent a lot of time in the middle of. That sounds really weird. Mr. B. Dolan. A lot of you will know that we just did a Speech of Animal Records tour and B. Dolan was the headliner on that. Thank you very much for everyone that came along to that and made so many of the shows sold out shows. But it's not just a show. He is a rapper, but a lot of you who know of him will know that he's also an activist. So we have a really good chat about politics, about independent music, about, you know, making a stand for what you believe in and all sorts of other really interesting stuff. So I recommend you check that out. Please subscribe on iTunes or at scroobiuspip.co.uk on the Distraction Pieces podcast tab. Yeah, thank you for tuning in and we will see you next week. Peace.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.